It was only game five, but it was a fun one. So we're going to jump a little bit into Warriors Clippers, and we're also going to get into another team in the Western Conference, the team that lost to the Warriors in the Western Conference Finals. I'm Brian Gibberman here with Seth Partnow on the Podium Game Podcast. Seth of NylonCalculus.com always does an awesome job there. Seth, what's going on today?
Oh, not much. How you doing?
I'm doing well. It was a weird, it was a really weird game, right? It was just some stuff happened that wasn't, I guess every NBA game has its own quirks in it, but I thought just the flow of this game was especially weird. You agree or disagree?
Yes, though I think you know the cliche is it's a game of runs, and I think we saw that. It just we saw some of them at predictable times, and one in particular at kind of a very odd time. And I'm speaking of the Clippers run in the third quarter with Chris Paul on the bench was unexpected, shall we say.
Yet they lost ground when Steph Curry went to the bench with foul trouble early in the first quarter, and then they made up ground when Chris Paul went to the bench for themselves. That's why it was that's kind of one of the main points of why this game was weird to me.
So some of that is somewhat predictable. A piece I wrote on Nylon Calculus today. The first big Warriors run was kind of late first, early second quarter, which is actually fairly typical against the Clippers because of I don't know necessarily because of, but coincidental with their usual practice of going to four and five bench players at once, and especially kind of at the start of the second quarter, since Steph went out early with foul trouble, he's playing a lineup against. He had about a 3 minute run against all bench players right at the start of the second quarter, and coincidentally or no, that was kind of a big run the Warriors put on. So that's the part where you can say, okay, that makes sense what just happened. Whereas in the third quarter, it was kind of the opposite.
Yeah, and you thought, I thought when Paul got that early foul that it might end up in a weird, like at first I was like, oh no, they're in trouble, but they went on the run. Then I also thought, hey, maybe this works out okay because it forces, as in the story, you wrote a Doc Rivers Death Valley lineup in Balances in Action. It's a story you actually wrote today that it might have forced him to stagger the lineups a bit, and I don't remember. Did he end up doing that, or did he just kind of do what he normally did?
A little bit. I think that kind of. I don't think they played that much in the second half with both Blake and Chris Paul on the bench, and that's really kind of. Certain, those are their two best creators, and you know, in the first half, there was you know they played 5, 6 minutes in a row with all three of their best players and those two and DeAndre Jordan on the bench at once, and that's not something you can necessarily get away with against the Warriors, I think. And through happenstance, I think they went away from that for the second half. And I don't think it was necessarily by design, as you said. It was kind of Paul's own foul trouble kind of switched up the script a little bit.
There's some stuff about the Clippers bench I like, and there's some stuff I don't. I like the job, like with where Josh Smith is at this point in his career, and for all the flaws he have, I still think he can be a positive player in the right situation. I do like him playing center. I really can't stand. I despise the Austin Rivers, Jamal Crawford backcourt. It's just too. Look, there's players in the league like this, and again, if used correctly at times, that you can make them into. They cannot be as detrimental, but their skill sets are too repetitive to me to be playing together.
You're not going to get any argument on from me over that. I think that's something we kind of when we thought that Stevenson was going to be coming off the bench, and then that was going to be kind of the three people across the perimeter was even more of that. It's hard to see, to be honest, how you fit you fit all three of those guys into the same rotation, just because having more than one of them on the court at any given time seems wholly duplicative. in a non-positive way.
At this point, is Rivers better than Crawford? Is that a real thing?
Oof. That might be.
It kind of hurts to say, doesn't it?
Yeah. I think especially for if he's they're going to be playing in the second half, I think Rivers is better defensively. I don't think he's great defensively, but I mean by comparison. So that's for the more ideal role he should be playing. He gives them more on that side of the ball. So that's I think one thing to look at. And this seems really weird. I almost wanted them to have Wesley Johnson on that spot, just to have a guy with just a little bit of length, and also who is going to not try to do a lot with the ball on offense. But that's neither here nor there.
Like Wesley is, if he was just better at what he did,
right.
he's what you want. He's just not as he's like kind of what Matt Barnes is, except not as good at it.
So he's played decently well in the early going for the Clippers, because he is being put in the perfect role for his skill set. But as you say, they had a better guy.
He's fun. I think maybe it's because of the draft status and when he got picked and whatnot. I think Wesley Johnson's he's fine.
Yeah.
He's shot a decent percentage on threes, and if you stick him around a bunch of other really good players, he's not going to kill you.
I think that's sort of how I feel. And like I said, maybe he is the most appropriate guy on their roster to be that fifth guy closing games. Especially if they're, as seems is the case, they don't trust Lance to do that yet. Lance has played pretty decently at times for them as well. There's still some quirks you get with him, but especially last night, I mean, he moved the ball, he competed on defense. He's not an all-star level player for whatever anyone thought for that one half season in Indiana, but you know, it's as your fifth guy on the court, that doesn't kill you.
He even made 2 threes last night.
Yeah, and you know, had some nice passes. I think that he and Blake might be developing a little bit of a chemistry with Stevenson looking for Blake in good spots for easy shots. So that's, you know, maybe a process, but if one is an optimist, that's for the Clippers, that's something to look for growth over the course of the season.
He was someone I was wrong about. I thought he was going to end up being a better player than he was.
Yeah, I do think the jury is still out on him. Last year was so disastrous that I almost want to just throw it out because it was, you know, I think he was hurt and it was a bad fit and system, and then stuff piled up on each other and it snowballed into a complete disaster. And you know, at the level he played his 1 year in Charlotte, he's not an NBA player, but I think that, you know, I think we could probably all agree that that's underperforming his true level of ability somewhat. So there might still be something there. And plus, you know, all you have to do to get him is trade Spencer Hawes, then I think you make that gamble.
And especially when you can get out of his contract,
yeah,
like
exactly.
He can. There was no reason not to make that trade. It was good for them from a salary cap perspective also. What are you seeing out of Pierce? Does he look anything different than last year, or is he just forced into that the team doesn't fit as well around him as when he was allowed to play small ball four in Washington?
It's some of that. I think that to some extent he the way that that the Rivers Crawford backcourt kind of, because he's a guy who, you know, can do things with the ball in his hands, but if those are the guards he's playing with, how often does the ball find him? So that's, and you know, it's hard to evaluate Paul Pierce visually just because he's looked the same for he's had an old man game for, you know, 8 years. So the fact that he's playing an old man game now, you have to really look closely to decipher how effective it's being. I don't know. I think his biggest problem right now is probably defensively, and that probably behooves him playing the four against bench units. But, yeah, we'll see. It's you don't want to make pronouncements about this guy or that guy's done 5 games into the season, I think.
No, that's probably a good idea. I agree.
Yeah.
Especially...
And, I said this, I went on Clipper Blog Live last night, and, you know, it's funny, they just lost a game by 4 on the road to the defending champions who are playing out of this world, and we're nitpicking them. So it's, you know, they're 4-1 with the only loss on their record. Can't be called anything but a good loss. And so, you know, they're fine.
Pablo Prigioni, he's old, and
he
kind of, like, a younger version of him is basically exactly what the Clippers bench unit needs.
Yeah. Like, Corey Joseph, though he was obviously well out of their price range this summer, but that's kind of the kind of sticky, clingy backup, defensive backup point guard who can hit a shot here and there, but mostly is just going to, you know, run the team a little bit and play solid defense.
The cliche true point guard when you have Jamal Crawford and Austin Rivers as your backcourt mate is kind of what you're looking for. I think everyone kind of agrees with that. Let's talk about the Warriors a little bit here. What's scary to me is, number one, Bogut's not playing. Number two, Klay Thompson shooting 29% from three right now. And what's happening is happening.
Yeah, though on the other side, I mean, that's, you got to figure that's a little bit of variance on the other side. You know, Steph Curry is not this good. Like,
we assume.
I mean, if like his current level of play extrapolated over a whole season is the best player in NBA history by like a wide margin. So it's just. There's a little bit of Bayesian reasoning, and you're like, that's probably not the case.
I'm kidding with you. But yes, I'm figuring that he's not going to score, like, 3 points per possession for the rest of the season.
Right.
And if he does, good for you.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. That'd be kind of fun to watch, though.
I mean, it is kind of fun to watch, and I think that a little bit of maybe what some of the if the other Warriors can be said to be struggling a little bit, which I think is harsh, but I think, you know, even they kind of are you know, they have the best seat in the house kind of for the best show in the league right now, so it's almost hard to blame them for you know, taking a moment to watch. You know?
Yeah, it's like Green went 1-for-6 from 3 last night. Iguodala was 0-for-4. Klay was 0-for-2. You'd be like, okay, that's exactly what you're looking for on a night. You're going to beat the Warriors. Like, those guys are, you know, kind of be like that. But then Curry, 7 of his 8 makes were from 3, and he's just chucking shots for, and it just completely cancels all that out.
And his confidence level right now is just ludicrous. I think that's, you know, how does he get better is just shoot more. And I think just being so confident means that, like, yeah, I can shoot this. Yeah, it'll go in. And it's like there may be even slightly worse shots than the one he was getting. But the margin between, you know, how good his kind of the next shot he can take is, and, you know, the floor for what would be a good shot is so great that he, like, just the fact that he's kind of pushing that boundary is right now is what's making him so, like, ridiculously effective.
What did you think of the Clippers defense against him?
You know, it's funny because you can play well for, you know, 8 out of 10 possessions, and then those two, you have a tiny breakdown, and it looks terrible. And, you know, and I think that for the most part, they actually did a reasonably good job. But there was, you know, they miscommunicate a switch, and he drills a three. They take a bad angle, you know, guarding a baseline screen, and he drains a three from the corner. You know, DeAndre Jordan is like, you know, 6 inches too far back on a pick and roll, and he drills 27 footers in his face. I think they did it reasonably well, and it just, you know, he's at this point playing well enough right now that reasonably well might not matter.
It's the level of detail and attention you have to have in areas of the court you don't typically have to. Like, you have to be paying attention, and within length of being able to contest the shot 28 feet away. It's just, it has to be awkward for players to do that, because they're not used to it.
And at some point also, you even with him, you kind of have to say, it's like, if he's going to make that, we might have to live with that. If the only other option is, like, we have to trap him, you know, 35 feet from the basket every possession and then give up a 4-on-3. Maybe that is the answer, but that's a hard way to play defense against the four other guys.
Especially when Draymond Green is as good of a passer as he is, and that's either going to end up in the center getting a dunk or a Klay Thompson corner three.
Yeah, or Harrison Barnes, you know, had a nice spurt last night, kind of hitting threes, getting to the bucket. So, you know, they have those other players are all competent enough that ignoring them is not always a great option.
Yeah, the two Barnes threes is kind of what got the Warriors run going when they were down by 10 in the fourth quarter. That was what kind of turned the tide of the game and got their run started.
Yeah, and that and a fast break dunk, and all of a sudden, you know, even the skeptics love Harrison Barnes.
he's fine. He's as long as you have him in the right role and you're not asking him to be the best player on your team, and he's allowed to be a complimentary piece, he's going to be a just fine and positive. They have a 20-point differential right now. I did not realize that.
Yeah, and I mean, it was before last night. It was like 25.
And the Grizzlies have a -9 because of one game.
Yeah, they. This is gonna go down. But before last night, they had a 49. Net rating in the third quarters of games.
Oh my god! I was getting ready to ask you the next question. I brought up the NBA standings, and I'm seeing these things for the first time. I'm just like, holy shit, Jesus! All right. So, if you had to pick one team in the Western Conference that matches up best with the Warriors, who would you pick?
I don't. It matches up isn't. It's almost like, rather than match up with the Warriors, the team that creates
the most problems
from of their own, yeah.
I like how you know what? I like how you asked yourself the question better than I did.
Because I think trying to match up with the Warriors, they're the best team in the league at playing their style. And so, you know, any other team is basically playing a road game almost to try to match that. So I think that, I don't know, a team like... OKC, or it's either, at this point, it's either OKC or San Antonio, or the two that have the way Westbrook is playing, and, you know, the possibility that they could just kind of physically overwhelm the Warriors if you know, their main guys are healthy is one. And then, you know, the Spurs are kind of a work in progress still, but their length and Kawhi Leonard, in particular. I mean, they have. If you want to talk about guys who might have the best chance against Curry one-on-one, Danny Green and Kawhi Leonard aren't bad candidates for that. Just in terms of guys who both have the length to bother him and the quickness to stay with him somewhat.
You're only allowed to get one for a 7-game playoff series: Warriors Thunder or Warriors Spurs.
Oof. As a fan who likes to consume the games on social media, I'd say the Spurs, just because there's a lot of dumbness that comes with the Thunder. Just in terms of the great is Russell Westbrook a point guard or not debate is exhausting.
Oh, I would tune that out And I think I would take Warriors Thunder and just ignore that.
Either one would be pretty awesome though. I mean, as would Thunder Spurs, as would, you know.
That's not Seth. That's not how this works. It's it's definitive answers, and we have to yell at each other.
Okay. It's one of my professors used to say, if I want to change the hypothetical, pay more tuition. Is that what you're telling me?
Yes, exactly. All right, let's do – I don't want to keep you here for like 8 hours. So let's go to the – we're going to talk about the Rockets a little bit. What you had some really cool charts that Daryl Morey acknowledged. That was pretty cool. What are you seeing that's going wrong with them so far, even though they have won two in a row?
They're not playing very good defense, and they're missing all their shots.
That's like a bad combination.
Yeah, no, it's the early season give them time to gel thing is if you were an optimist, and I was a preseason optimist on the Rockets, those are the things you look at. Harden, Lawson haven't quite. They haven't quite figured out how to have Harden play off Lawson as much as I thought they were going to. And there's still time for that, obviously, because it seems to me that, Harden is great, even if he's going against just a set defense. And now imagine him doing the same thing against the guy closing out on him. And that's just a devastating offensive weapon. And now with a guy who can create with the ball in his hands alongside him, something they're hopefully we'll start to use more. Dwight looks bad physically. Looks worse than I expected. I was kind of thinking, hey, if they get 80% of Dwight Howard, that'll be good enough. But he looks like I was on Nate Duncan's podcast earlier this week, and Nate was talking about this, and I have to agree. He looks like a guy with a bad back.
You're going on all, and you're going on Jared. You're doing a pod. Is the one you're doing with Dubin going to be weekly, or is that just a one-time thing?
I think we're planning on doing it weekly to talk about the Thursday night games.
That's cool. Looking forward to that. I was about to say you're on all of the podcasts this week. You hit on two. I think you hit on two important points there. It's let's do Dwight first. It's amazing how good he still is, even though I agree with you. He just doesn't look good moving around, but he still has a positive impact on the game.
I think the bigger problem is that that movement is affecting him defensively more than offensively. Just because on offense he can kind of pick where he wants to go, and then that kind of the lack of or the reduction in mobility caused by the back is less of a problem. Whereas on defense, if he's kind of reading and reacting. That half second to half a beat to get moving in the new direction is hurtful for their defense, I think.
And then the Harden Lawson thing, it's not clicking yet, but when you watch it, you see, and your point is very well taken. When one of them has the ball, and instead of it being Patrick Beverley as the guy on the wing who's not much of a dribble shot creator, is more just a spot-up shooter, and now the ball gets swung to one of them, and they get to attack the defense on the move from the wing, how easily they can get into the paint is really, it's really obvious, and if they can kind of get everything going together and make it smoother, that should be, I'm confident that they can figure it out offensively, and it'll eventually be really dangerous.
And Harden isn't going to shoot 20 whatever percent from three all year. I think that's a big part of it too. I mean, a lot of everything looks ugly when a team that shoots a lot of three pointers isn't making any three pointers. So a little bit of shot making will go a long way. But still, they do have to play better aside from just making or missing shots.
And it's I think it's part of. I mean, they're basically replacing Terrence Jones with Marcus Thornton right now, and Thornton's been he makes sense for this team, and I think he could be a very good role player for them off the bench. He fits with what they want to do. He can come in, he'll be able to bomb. Like, he could be he won't be able to play point guard like Jason Terry last year, but if he plays the two or the three or whatever, and he comes off the bench, there's no reason he can't help this team with his three-point shooting. But having him with your first unit instead of Terrence Jones hurts your defense.
Yeah, and you know, and having Jones out and Mota Yunus out, and you know, I'm a little surprised we haven't seen any KJ McDaniels this year. I think one of the reasons I was high on the Rockets to begin with is they have so many of these young athletic guys. They don't need all of them to work. And you know, so far Harrell and Capella have looked pretty decent as, you know, as rotation fill-in guys. And so that's if those two guys can be on the floor, it's already two of those guys who've worked out. But I think a lot of us were kind of hoping that one of them would be KJ McDaniels, and that hasn't really happened yet.
Good transition there, Seth. All right, Clint Capella, yes, he's good.
Yeah,
like he jumped the first time I really noticed him. Like I knew who he was. I remember he came to Phoenix for draft workouts and we talked to him. I'm not going to pretend like I knew much about him, but when the first time he really jumped out at me was in the Western Conference Finals, and he was getting put on Steph Curry in switches and pick and rolls, and he might have done a better job on him than any other Rockets big man.
I might not limit that to Rockets big men. I think aside from, you know, Anthony Davis, I think he did about as well as anyone. You know, picking up Steph on switches, and I hear Cleveland fans making Tristan Thompson noises and just
Capella was he had much better balance to him when he was guarding. Steph couldn't get him off balance as easily as he could get Tristan off balance.
Yeah, I agree with that. There's actually, if I'm remembering back, there was actually a couple times where like Capella actually like kept him from getting a shot off. And that's, you know, most guys, it's like, all right, stay close and hope to contest the shot that he eventually takes. And Capella was actually able to, you know, whether it was Capella or Steph just not making the right move one or two times. So you don't want to go crazy because, again, everything with Capella right now is just a tiny sample size. So it's very easy and tempting to extrapolate. over a whole season, he would be, you know, he'd be Hassan Whiteside, but better, or something like that, which is, you know, crazy.
Yeah, that's it's unfair. But this is kind of I was thinking about this from a player development standpoint, and there was I was thinking about Philadelphia and Nerlens Noel, who they're not the same, but just how one is basically getting the opportunity to just do so much more than he probably should be offensively at this point, while Capella is very limited to what he's able to do. And he's shown he has done like a little bit offensively, where more than just catching the ball and dunking. He's done some, but just how like what the difference in Noel's career would be if he was ended up on the Rockets and in a very specific role, while if Capella was allowed to expand himself and try different things with the 76ers.
I think that's probably a little unfair on Noel, who is, I think, the more talented.
He's
with significantly better ball skills coming in, I think. And, you know, not a still a developing shooter, but just his passing ability. He's not a great ball handler, but he's a guy who can, you know, catch the ball on a pick and roll, take one dribble, and make a read.
He's good at finding that guy in the corner. You're right. I am being a little bit unfair to him, but in just the being able to try and experiment a little bit.
Yeah, that's, you know, there's positives and negatives to that. I've been somewhat outspoken about, you know, not liking some of the things that Philadelphia has done from a tactical standpoint rather than a strategic standpoint. You're not going to hear me argue that like tearing their roster down and building it back up was the wrong way to go. I think that was absolutely right. But a lot of the problem with the experimentation is he's in an environment where the feedback from that experiment isn't necessarily accurate. You know what I mean? It's if he, you know, you talk about him making a read and finding that guy in the corner. Well, if the guy he's finding in the corner is, you know, any Philly wing player not named Robert Covington, the positive feedback of making a nice pass and the guy draining a shot, it just happens less because, you know, you're finding I don't want to name names because it's mean, but you're finding, you know, sub NBA rotation level players and who are going to do sub NBA rotation level things, and you know that it's hard to learn in an environment where the correct play won't get rewarded as much, and the improper play might get rewarded more, and that's kind of how bad habits are formed.
We're here. We'll just do this for a little bit. There's some semblance of a roster start. I think it's starting to be formed in Philly a little bit. I know Covington just got hurt, but you got the two big guys. You got Covington. You have Stauskas. And
you got the two big guys. You got Covington and
he's called. Come on, all right. Maybe I'm a Michigan fan, so I'm a little.
No, I know.
I'm a little bit biased here. I admit that, but I do think he can. He can at least. I know he shot 3 for 14 last night, but he can at least shoot a basketball. So that's like a step in the right direction.
So that. Yeah, that's, you know, that's something, and obviously you've got, you know, whatever Embiid becomes and Sarge still to come, but we're in the third year of the process, and aside from the lottery picks, like, Covington is all you have to show for that development time. That's not great. That's not good. That's not good enough. You know, that's something has gone wrong with the other parts of the quote the process for you to not have found anything else of kind of, you know, long-term value, even if it's not something that's you know, you see like the snickering over like the Jeremy Lamb contract or something, which as an aside I think was fine, but as the kind of, well, we're not going to make that mistake. Yeah, you're not going to make that mistake because you don't have any players who are even plausibly worth that. So you won't even be put to those kind of decisions, and I don't see how that's better. Like that's the wrong way to avoid bad decisions, is just to avoid having to make decisions on signing on re-signing your own good players or not.
I like your Jeremy Lamb mention there, and we can pivot this away from the Sixers so we don't go down this road for an hour. But so that's a good pivot. It's funny. You notice this a lot. There, a lot of people, including myself at times, so I'll throw myself in, complain about a lot of contracts, and then not too long after, they end up being fine.
Yeah, and I think it's, especially now, you know, it's easy to justify every contract. Well, in new NBA money, it's blah, blah, blah.
I don't like doing that either. Yeah. It's both sides. Like, there's an overreaction to, look, there are still bad contracts, but there are also, like, Reggie Jackson's was one that I think was a pretty, did you like Reggie's or no?
I didn't. He's justifying it somewhat. I just thought from kind of a leverage perspective, they didn't do well. And to some extent, Detroit is actually kind of paying for not minding the details very well. Because you know they've had a good start to the season, which is really threatened to be derailed by the fact that they have zero depth on the wing. And you know that's the extra couple million they're paying Aaron Baines, the extra couple million that maybe Jody Meeks got, the $5.5 million of dead Josh Smith money, you know, all of a sudden you're talking $7-9 million. That's a decent backup wing or two, and that's something that this team could use a lot right now. And so it's you know, individually, like, missing by a little bit on any one deal might not be crushing, but you know, collectively, all of a sudden, if you have you know, $10-11 million on your books, including Reggie Jackson, who's kind of quote unquote overpays, that's two guys in your rotation, right?
Yeah, and when you lose and you lost Meeks, who is an NBA level wing that could have came off the bench, and then Stanley Johnson, who everyone got really excited about because the preseason hasn't been playing nearly at that same level, all of a sudden you're in trouble.
And Stanley Johnson's gonna be a good player.
Oh yeah, yeah, but
it's just if to the extent that you are thinking that, you know, big progress and maybe a playoff run this season is something that would be desirable. He's probably a year away from that being, you know, a realistic expectation for him.
But in the East, even with that lack of depth, I think they might be okay.
Yeah, and starting out hot is going to be down at kind of the 7th through 10th seed of the East. It's going to be close enough that, you know, banking a couple wins early. And I'm blatantly ripping off a point from Nate Duncan here, but banking those wins early is a nice little cushion to have. You look at them in comparison to, you know, Indiana or Milwaukee, and though both Indiana and Milwaukee have kind of righted the ship a little bit, though Milwaukee just beat Philly, so yay.
Not really impressed with Milwaukee.
Yeah, I will say I don't think they've been as bad as their initial start was. If you dig into the numbers a little bit, like, teams have shot approximately a billion percent on open threes against them and have hit a bunch of mid-range shots too. That doesn't mean their defense has been good, but I think it's not been quite as bad as some of the early numbers would indicate.
And they didn't have, they didn't have Giannis in the Knicks game, which definitely played something into it. Parker still finding his way. You put aside, because it's, as you're right, you have to, these numbers early in the season, I try and kind of avoid it a little bit and just go off watching until we get a larger sample size, but it's impossible to avoid looking at stuff too. That it's just the mix of players is a little awkward to me.
Yeah, I think that there's a good rotation in there. It's just kind of chipping away and finding it. And I think actually a guy that they might be missing a little bit, and this is going to sound weird, is OJ Mayo.
No, it's not weird. He can make threes, and the team needs shooting.
Yeah, and from a backup bench with guard perspective, he's never going to be like a lockdown defender, but as compared to, you know, a guy like Grievous Vasquez or Jared Bayless, I mean, he's, I think, better defensively than those guys.
Yeah, there's no argument for me. And there's value in having that guy who once every 5 or 6 games is going to get scorching hot and can carry your offense for a stretch.
Especially for a team that has, you know, limited shot creation abilities on the perimeter.
Yeah, that definitely makes sense. All right, we're about 40 minutes here. I'll let you go. I think I bothered you enough for one day. Because we'll bother you again down the road, so we won't bother you too much for one day. Anything you want to get out there and plug from Nylon Calculus or anywhere else that you're doing stuff?
We talked about it a little bit. I have been looking a lot at kind of bench versus starting units, and kind of what I found was that we alluded to it earlier, is that at least last season, there's kind of, you know, you watch enough NBA, you know, that kind of at the between the last timeout in the first quarter and the first timeout in the second quarter, that's kind of when the subs play. And looking at it, I think the Clippers were the 4th or 5th worst team in the league over that stretch of time last year, with only teams like Philly, New York, and Orlando, I think, were the ones that were worse than them. It's not just a one night thing when you say, hey, look, the Clippers gave up a big run during kind of that starter valley. It's not an every night thing, but a very common thing, and I think it's a problem. So that's something I wrote today at Nylon Calculus. And also, we are, with the new season starting, we have revamped and are updating and adding to kind of the range of interesting stats that our writers have come up with. So people should check that out if they want to see everything from which players are best at winning the opening tap to kind of some detailed shot value modeling. So check that out at Nylon Calculus.
At nyloncalculus.com. Very Seth and all the writers do great work there. The Knicks are single-handedly attempting to break your bench model this year.
Yeah. So how long it'll last before either Galloway or Grant is starting? That has to change at some point, doesn't it?
My heart rate would go down a little bit if it did. hopefully soon. All right, Seth, thank you very much. Appreciate it. That wraps up another edition of the Podium Game Podcast.